So this is week 6 of our 10-week series. So we're more than halfway through, which is pretty significant. So maybe we should have made caffeinated coffee, but we didn't. But we have decaf coffee, which is super exciting. So make sure you drink it up. Otherwise, I have to buy a Jacob lunch. We have 4 rules of conversation, which I think most of you know, but just in case, what are they? Don't be a jerk. Have grace. Don't be a wuss. Yeah, that's my favorite one. And eat and be merry. So between Andy and Vanessa's infinite wisdom, they're going to tackle all the mysteries of life. So we're going to finish solving them in 4 weeks. Yeah, I believe in you guys. I think that's it. I don't think I'm missing anything, am I? Yeah. All right, you're up.
Hey. Hi, I'm Vanessa. I've met most of you. Yes, there are 2 seats at our table. You guys should totally sit there. If you haven't grabbed them yet, there are 2 handouts that you can get up and get anytime for tonight. And you're at Origins. Like Eric said, we're over halfway through. Origins is talking about kind of the beginning. What are the stories that we come from? What does the Bible say is the beginning story? And by implication, this course has also made me think about the end, not like the end of time. I mean, like, what is this story all going towards? If there's a beginning, there's this sense of movement. Like, we're not static in these neutral waters, but things are going somewhere. So you're in a course talking about the beginning and where it's going, and all the stories that we're immersed in every day that might be competing with where we think it's going or where we think we're going or what the point is. So we're going to talk about more of that tonight. If you're new, some things you might not be getting the full repetition of something we've been talking about, but tonight's time together will be contained in itself, so you should be able to have fun. We've been starting with lighting a candle as a way to just have a micro ritual. And one of the things we'll do a little bit later, a liturgy audit. One of the quotes I like for a liturgy audit is micro rituals have macro implications. So it's just a very little thing to light a tiny candle and to take 1 minute. I don't even know how many minutes there are in the day that we're awake. To take 1 minute kind of feels like it could potentially be macro. And something I was reminded again today, a story that I heard that I really liked, was this pastor who's really busy and famous in San Francisco area, really busy. He called a spiritual director and said, you know, I need to get more spiritually healthy. What should I do? And this spiritual director said, relentlessly eliminate hurry from your life. He was like, ah, that is so great. Okay, great. And he wrote it down. And he was like, got it. Okay, what else? And he was like, that's it. And I heard that and was like, what? How could anyone say that? That is the key. I mean, you know, this is just one way to describe the key to spiritual health, but it's really made me think. Of course, it doesn't mean if, like, the bus, you're, like, gonna miss the bus that you don't run anymore or that there's not urgency in your life. But it has made me think about the state of hurry on the inside. There's a way of like running to like catch the bus where you're not like frantic on the inside. Or there's a way of interrupting someone and saying, I'm so sorry, I really have to make an appointment. Sorry for cutting you off, but I have to go. That's different than like when someone's talking and you're like, oh my gosh, what's happening? This is crazy. And now I'm gonna like have road rage trying to get to my thing. So I just want to take this minute of silence. So if someone at your table will light the candle and see if we can quiet a little bit of that running monologue or energy that we can get into on the inside. So feel free to close your eyes if it helps you to kind of be a little more present, but also feel free to just look at the flame. It can be helpful just to look at something. And let's take 1 minute and see if we, in the silence, can kind of relax into being here. Maybe to end the minute, if you're into this, try taking one big inhale and exhale. You count 4 seconds on the inhale. You hold for 11 seconds, and then you exhale for 7 seconds. It's kind of hard, especially the exhale. But let's try that together. So inhale for 4, hold for 11, exhale for 7. Find the exhale part so hard to do slowly. But what that little exercise is, I read about it for trying to fall asleep at night if you have troubles falling asleep. For me, it just helps me be aware that I have to breathe because of that slower inhale and then the holding part. And doing that can kind of relax the body, which is why it can be helpful for falling asleep at night. So great. Thanks for being present. We're going to learn from Andy now and talk a lot tonight.
Thanks, Vanessa. So you all are the victims of some fake news tonight. So Eric said this is class 6. It's actually class 7. But the reason Eric's confused is because I labeled the first class as class 0. So I think that threw him off. 6, right? But our last class is class 9. But it's really the 10th class because 0 was 1. Anyway, I know. We complicate things here at the table. But there's a point to it. And we talked about this a little while ago. I just want to remind you that besides class 0, the 9 classes are 3 sets of 3. So the first 3 sets, we looked at what is the gospel. And we're on the third of the last of the second trio. We're looking at what is the gospel formed. It's formed a new family around Jesus. And I'm not going to give any spoiler alerts for what the last 3 are going to be starting next week. You're going to have to come and check that out, okay? Well, along with 3 sets of 3, we want to kind of shape each of the classes in those triads, so they're a little bit different. So the first one is going to be looking at the old story. So we've been rooted in Genesis 2 and 3, 1, 2, and 3, and looking at what was the intention of creation, and then what went wrong. And then class 2 looks at how is this addressed in the life and death and resurrection and ascension of Jesus. And then class 3, we want to spend less time on teaching and more time on conversation. So tonight's emphasis is going to be how do we unpack together, how do we process together what this means for us or what this could mean for us. So that's going to be the focus of tonight. So there's going to be less of me up here teaching. We're going to dig less into scripture tonight and more trying to connect the dots. Why do we structure our table community the way that we do in light of the gospel-formed family? And why do we do the things we do? What's the practice? And then we're going to spend some time at our tables kind of unpacking that as a group. So quick recap. We started off this trio. Am I too loud? I feel loud up here. I can't hear you because of my own echoey voice. Are you saying yes?
A little loud.
What's that? Okay, Jacob's fixing it as we speak. So we started off a couple, the first of this family triad, talking about what to me was a mind-blowing thing, that God has always been a family. And the implications for that were just astounding. And one of those implications were that he didn't invent it for us. He didn't have to invent community. It was always present from before the beginning. And so us being in a community, us being identifying with a family is a one way that we actually image the Creator. So we were created to be a family. And then we looked at Genesis 3 and the aftermath of the rebellion and the fractured family, that now we experience family and community and friendships and all sorts of relationships in a very broken way. And relationships always tend kind of towards this atrophy or this brokenness, and we have to do a lot of work if we're going to maintain them and if we value them. And Genesis 2 and 3 have a lot of explanatory power. As we looked closely in them and say, yeah, this actually explains, if this is true, if this is a reliable account of our interaction with God and one another from the very beginning, this actually explains a lot about what we experience now in our communities and our families. And then last week we looked at how Jesus addresses this issue, the brokenness of the family or the fracturedness of the family, the disintegration of it. And we looked at specifically at a story that Jesus told about two sons, and it's often called the prodigal son. And we looked in depth at that and made some connections for what Jesus is inviting us into in terms of a new family. We looked at Acts and how that actually took place in the early church, that people were sharing everything together like a family would, even though they weren't related to each other. And not only within Jewish circles, but then that expanded out to non-Jewish circles. And so it didn't matter things like race or social status, male, female, all those things. They experienced life together as a new family centered around Jesus. And so that's what brings us to tonight. And I'm just curious, like, just spend a couple of minutes, if anyone in the big group here, if you were here last week or even in any of the previous two lessons on family, what's one thing that has really settled with you or stuck with you or just kind of been in the back of your mind these last few weeks from our time together?
Mm-hmm. But I also like, out of God has always been community, therefore, in order to know God, we need to be enveloped in a community. So that just speaks really well for me, because I'm an extrovert, but also because I have learned mostly about God in relation to other people as opposed to just some like scriptures on my own or just listening to a sermon.
That's good. Thanks, Almeida. What else? What else has stuck with you from this time?
I
Yeah. Yeah. I remember laying on my bed when I was a kid. I grew up in the church, and I had those moments for just God, God's self being eternal, and just like that just hurt my brain, the thought of something not having a beginning. And when I first kind of hit me this idea that, no, not just God has always been, but the Trinity, like God has always been a family. It was like, and I was an adult, and I, same thing, where it's like, whoa. It just kind of, it mesmerizes you, and you just kind of get lost in the wonder of it. How about one more? Yeah, Joanne. Yeah, that's interesting. God, it somehow makes God more approachable. The idea that he's always been a family, he's always had relationships, that he's created us for relationship. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah, that's good. So I want to invite Vanessa to come up. I really liked, she led for us a few weeks ago a liturgy audit. So do a bit more explaining about that again tonight to kind of refresh us about what that meant. But I thought it was so helpful and exposing in good ways and in some challenging ways. But it also, it's just such, it encapsulates so well what our class is about as we think about the fact that, or we're looking at how stories are everywhere, stories are shaping and forming us all the time, and we're not always aware of it. And so a big part of this class is how can we become more aware and reflective of the stories that are shaping us? And so that's a big part of what's behind the idea of the liturgy audit. So take it away.
Hi again. I have a handout for you. It has the four little boxes on that, if that helps you follow along at all. This idea of a liturgy audit was taken from this great book I mentioned called You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit by James K. A. Smith. He suggested in it, oh, you should do one of these. So it's kind of figuring out what would it look like to actually do one. To the last one we did was taking a daily audit. So what are some of the daily routines you just think of? This is something I do. And to turn it over and say, what is this doing to me? How is this maybe forming me? And is it deforming me, or is it forming me towards an end that I'm planning on or intentional about? So just to recap, liturgy is just shorthand for those things we do that are loaded with an ultimate story about who we are and what we're here for. And his point is that there are so many cultural liturgies that we wouldn't even recognize as liturgies, because we tend to think, oh, that's something you do in church when you're doing a call and response. And he gives the example of the mall and how the mall is a cultural liturgy, how consumerism is a cultural liturgy. We're immersed in it. We're being advertised for something. And part of the reason we're unconscious about it is because they go, they do a lot to make sure that we don't think too much about it. So tonight I thought the liturgy we could, the audit we could do would be about our relationships. So our family and our friends. And it might be helpful to just choose one, to either choose friendship or to choose family and home life. But if, I don't know how your brain works. For me, it's probably going to be taking, when we have a couple minutes alone, taking just an inventory of things that are coming to mind. Okay, what are some of the unconscious patterns and routines that I've fallen into? For example, with friends, what do I tend to do with friends? How do I communicate with friends? Is technology involved? and to just start to name some of those, to make a list of them, and not worry about translating what it means necessarily right away. Okay, maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit. A good story. The one, do you have it? Great. You just push a button? Amazing. Okay, I'll get right to that one. Okay, there's this great story about two stone cutters, and they're each asked what they're doing. And the first one says, oh, I'm working on cutting the stone into a perfect square. The other one's asked what he's doing, and he says, I'm building a cathedral. And when I heard that, I thought, that sounds like me. I would think the first person who's asked was like, oh, right, I'm building a cathedral too. I just got so focused on what I'm doing, I forgot about the bigger thing that this is for. And that just felt like my life, that I sometimes forget what this is all for. The areas that I talked about looking at, the friendships and the family relationships, are such a major part of our life that sometimes we fall into just trying to fit the little micro pieces into what we need to do that day instead of reflecting on it and wondering, okay, is this cathedral actually getting built? Is it going to look like when I wake up at 70 the way that I thought it would? This slide is a picture from Banksy. Have you guys heard of him? That artist who does those like surprising art all over the world. And this is kind of looking at the idea of ritual or liturgy from a negative perspective. So thinking about, quote on your page, that micro rituals have macro implications. This is an example of a micro ritual, which is just like checking our phones sometimes, an example of how it could have a macro implication in that these people who are going for intimacy, being known and knowing one another, might just be looking past the other in this habit that's built over time. So it's kind of, you know, a thought-provoking way of looking at that. Great, that one's for the next one, so don't worry about that. Another example in the book that's more positive example is the formative power of the dinner table. And this author calls it the dinner table education. So the dinner table is a place that so much schooling can happen about how to be in the world and who we are in the world. And not just the dinners that are like candlelit and it's the meal that everybody likes and it got out on time, but all the things that could go wrong as well. So for example, if there's sibling rivalry in your house around the dinner table, a cathedral example of that could be we're learning how to love our neighbor in a very real way. That's not something you would say over dinner like, oh, well, this is good practice because you're learning how to love your neighbor. But the idea is having a view of the dinner table where you get to incorporate what real life does bring and kind of frame it towards the end that you're hoping to go for. So another little example I thought of is if the meal is something, you know, that someone doesn't like, instead of kind of writing it off as like, oh, well, that's too bad for you. It's an opportunity in a subtle way to say, okay, what does flourishing as a human and in our bodies look like, and how is that sometimes different than my own personal preferences? And what does flourishing in the world and what we eat in what seasons, how is that different than what I personally like? How is there something bigger going on where these little micro rituals of what we eat and how we talk at the dinner table, what they might ultimately form over years of doing it? That's one example of a liturgy of the family, is to look at some of the basic things that we do that we might not be too aware of. So when we take this personal little audit, we'll have at least 5 minutes to reflect by ourselves, but then we'll talk about it at the tables, which I think will be the place where we kind of really maybe unearth some things. So just to make it a little more clear, I feel like my handout might be a little confusing. What I'm asking is for us to list, you can even turn the page over and just do it on a blank page. Choose either your family to think about or your friendships to think about. Enlist some of the routines that you just that are normal in terms of how you communicate, where you tend to relate to them, like in what setting. Some of the basic things we're formed around over the centuries is food and music with words. Food, music, and words are main ones. I don't think I can think of anything else, but does your relationships involve these? And if so, how? And then a second part I thought, if there's time to think about, would be what is the liturgy of your home or your living environment? So your room in a house that you share with people or your home as a whole, and what symbols in our homes are shaping us or communicating what we value or maybe not communicating what we value. One example, my friend is an artist, and he has this, he does kind of Banksy-like art. This is that famous picture of God and man touching fingers, but he has it in front of the television. I don't know if you can all see that. But it's a provocative image that this kind of lounging, what was meant to be like a restful, contented, relational posture is looks very similar to what it might look like to just be chowing out in front of the TV. So this is an example of what the center of your living room is. Where is it? What is it facing? Is it facing the TV? And what does that communicate? This isn't meant to like totally overwhelm you or me or make us feel guilty. It's just to unearth some of the liturgies and the things that we're doing so that we can potentially be a little bit more conscious of what we're going for and how to get there. Does that make sense? Great. So let's do a few minutes by ourselves, taking that audit of our relationships, and then I'll come back up and we'll turn it to the tables to talk. Let's now move into talking about this at our tables. Let's do 10 minutes and see if that's enough time. And we'll go longer if it's not. So I feel like we'll learn from each other by everyone sharing. So if it's possible for everyone to share at your table, let's aim for that. And if you don't have anything to share and you just want to listen, that's totally fine. But let's just be conscious of making space if someone hasn't shared yet. And you can just share one something that surprised you or a couple things or a theme that you just never thought about before. And then I think if we all do that together, our list will grow. And then later on tonight, there might be some ways to take some of the things we noticed and turn them into some more intentional habits. I'd love to take a few minutes to hear from some people, if anybody's willing to share. So it doesn't have to be recapping what your table talked about, but just something that surprised you or something that you thought like, oh yeah, this is really conducive to where I'm hoping this relationship is going. Or no, this actually takes away from what I have in mind for how this relationship or this way of living or being could be forming me. Yeah, Kai? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's not what you were thinking you'd think about. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting, yeah. That's such a good point. Work could be, we could totally do an audit of work and our habits and routines and assumptions around work. That's like the third person that's not mentioned here that we should be talking about. Yeah, Jacob. Yeah. Totally. Our table talked a lot about that too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Cooking. One little thing I noticed, just in thinking about, okay, what do I do with my friends? Is I realized, I mean, for every 10 times I go to someone else's house, I probably have someone to my house. And that goes way back to when I was growing up and we weren't the house anyone came over to because there was nothing in the cupboards, like no sugar cereal, no fruit roll-ups, no cheese sticks, you know what I mean? Like we just didn't have those kinds of things. So I associate that with what little kids want to come over. We always went to the houses that had the like walk-in pantries. Because if you have a walk-in pantry, you're a house that's like, come on over. We're like ready for you. We've got extra. And my house's vibe was like, we barely have enough for the kids here. So we can't really house you. So I grew up never having anyone over or sleep over anything, and I still do that. I just rarely have people over. I just initiate, oh, I'm going to come to you. And what it made me think about is what does that maybe communicate to me about how important I am, or like being a welcoming person or the one hosting. I'm always on the receiving end at people's houses. So it just made me think for the first time, like, well, it would be a discipline to be like, no, you have to come here. And then to have sugar cereal for them or something.
My mom didn't care if we
Mm-hmm. Those are other things. Interesting. Is there one more? And we'll move on. Or not. That's so great. I remember asking you like what you do, and you were like, "Oh, we just talk for a couple hours and just you sit around the table and talk." You're like, yeah, we do. So great. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Andy's going to help us keep thinking about these things and maybe work some of them through into some practical ideas towards the end.
Yeah, so we looked at some of our personal community or family or friendship liturgies, or kind of wrestled with it, and some of those and some of the questions that kind of naturally come up is, where do those come from? So we look back at kind of our growing up, habits that were formed there, some that probably just get imported by the culture that we live in because they're just there and that's what people do, and then in other places too. And so now I want to connect just briefly, this isn't going to be super deep, but hopefully connective, just to kind of explain why we do what we do at the table community and related to our liturgy, which is more, I think our liturgy is more obvious because it, for one reason, it's just weird. It's different. It's an alternative. The church is designed to present an alternative story, an alternative liturgy for life that at different times overlaps with the culture and kind of works well with it. Other times kind of comes up against it, and it's like, this is weird. Why are grown-up people coming together and singing songs out loud? Where do you do that? Other than at like a U2 concert or something like that, right? That's strange. So some of it's very obvious from people who haven't grown up going to church, like, this is a different thing, and I don't know what they're doing. So I want to talk again about baptism and communion. We did this a few weeks ago for the end of the gospel, and the reason we keep coming back to this is because these are the central stories or liturgies of the church. And in fact, I would argue that everything else we do is sort of derivative. They kind of come out of what we're doing when we do baptism and when we do communion. And so I'm just going to go through these kind of quickly to kind of recap on some of them and how I see them connecting. So this is our practice at the table. And for baptism, I want to look at just four images that kind of overlap with what we're talking about when we're talking about the new family, the reordered family that is reoriented around Jesus. And the first thing is that baptism is a transfer. It's a transfer of loyalties. It's a pledge of allegiance to a king, which is sort of odd because we don't live in a, well, I guess we kind of, do we kind of live in a monarchy here in Canada? I get confused here. Constitutional monarchy, I don't, okay. It's not as potent as it once was, right? We'll put it that way. But this is the image that one of the images we're giving, and one of the purposes or one of the symbols of baptism is a pledge of allegiance. You think in terms of citizenship, and Paul actually uses this language in his letter to the Ephesians, that we're transferring our primary citizenship from whatever we want to primarily identify with as a Canadian citizen or an American citizen or whatever, or our heritage or whatever else it is, to our primary allegiance is to Christ. So then, you are no longer strangers. You are no longer aliens. You're no longer outsiders to this family of God, but you are now fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. Look at all the images in there in terms of belonging and members of a family in the language of citizenship and belonging. So that's one thing that we're doing when we do baptism, when we're performing or when we're celebrating a baptism together. A second thing that we're doing is we're making a covenant. And these are all overlapping. These are all different images to kind of talk about overlapping ideas. Covenant commitment to follow the way of Christ, to follow Christ. And we talked last week about Jesus redefining family around those who do the will of the Father. Remember, we looked at that part in the gospel text. And sure enough, after his death, resurrection, and ascension, you see the church being formed and acting like a family who's sharing stuff and figuring out life together. You know, so these bonds and connections are superseding that even of our biological families, or at least that's what's happening in the book of Acts and in the New Testament. And that's pretty radical. A third image is that of adoption. Points to our ultimate belonging. Similar idea to the covenant one just now. Paul writes in Romans, talking about the Spirit that you received, and receiving the Spirit is tied to this symbol of baptism, right? If you remember from the gospel stories, Jesus went out to be baptized, and the Spirit of God came down upon him in the form of a dove. And at Pentecost, when Peter is preaching to the crowds, and they all become baptized, it says they received God's Spirit. So these things seem to be tied together. Not identical, but tied together. And Paul talks about in Romans, the Spirit you received does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. He's talking about what's the nature of our relationship to God. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. It's a different kind of relationship. We saw that in the story of the prodigal son. Oh my goodness, I've really messed up. I've offended my father. I told him I wish he was dead, but I'm in trouble here. Let me go back and I'll be a servant in his household. And as soon as he got back, the father's reaction made it very clear that that wasn't going to happen. You are a son. You received, brought about your adoption to sonship, and by him we cry, Abba, Father. And the fourth image idea is tied to baptism is conversion. Points to our outward participation in community, even a new birth is what it's called in the New Testament at times. It's a whole new creation. And this is where, so we've called our leadership track at the table, we call kaleo. It comes from another word called ecclesia, which we've talked about in here, which is the gathering. If you remember the story, that's what we thought we were going to name the church. It's going to be the gathering because that's the New Testament word for what we're doing. So let's just do that. Let's just be obvious about it. Only use Greek because that's kind of cool. In ecclesia. But we're going to call it the gathering, but we couldn't do that because someone else had that name. We called it the table instead. And gather around a table, you know. And ecclesia means gathering. It's from the verb kaleo, which means to call. And that prefix ek is out of, so it really means, it kind of means the called out ones. And that's kind of the image we get, is that we're transferring our allegiance, we're transferring our citizenship, we're becoming an alternative community in the world that's centered around this person, named Jesus. And so Acts 4, the end of Acts 4, gives a nice little summary statement of that early community, that gathering that was happening, the practice of the true reordered family. All the believers were one heart and mind, so this is focused on being on the same page, being unity, being a family. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles, those were the ones that were with Jesus, continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all, there were no needy persons among them. From time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as they had need. So you get this reordered family happening that's transcending these biological connections and ties. Okay? And so that's some of the images around what's happening when we are baptized. And the second liturgical thing that we do is communion. It's gathering around a table. And if you come to the table, you'll hear Josh or I sometimes describe, when we're up there leading communion, we describe it as God's family table. This is a powerful symbol of what God has done for us in Christ. And we're participating in that symbol together. And so we come together around a table. God's family table. And the second thing, there's three things to think about when you come up to communion. There's can be a lot more, but here's three of them. I didn't want to overwhelm you. When you come up, there's something to receive. And we can receive Christ's past work in the bread and the wine. So you've heard us use this language before, that Jesus, in Christ, God did the heavy lifting for us. He did the things we couldn't do. He confronted our adversary who had power over us, and he won. And you see that unfolding in the story of the Gospels. And so when we come up for communion, you can receive something that Christ did for you in the past on your behalf. You're looking back. But there's also something to look forward to. One of the main images of the end, what we're all heading for on the other side of death when we belong to Jesus, is this party, this banquet, in fact. The main image in the Bible, one of the main images, is a party with lots of food. Okay? So a lot of our images of heaven might be of clouds and harps and white gowns and wings. Philadelphia cream cheese. Which is interesting and maybe sounds like fun for about 15 minutes to me. But the idea of going to a party, like this is the main image of being in God's kingdom, sounds a lot more exciting and tasty and enjoyable and fun. And I think that's why the image was chosen. So there's something to look forward to, a huge celebration feast. So that's something to think about. And there's also something for now, and it's tied to that thing that we're anticipating. And sometimes we use the term, the image for communion is sort of like a little appetizer, because it seems kind of silly to call it a feast, because you're not getting a lot. And so it might feel a little bit odd when you come up and you get a little thing and you have a little sip of the wine. But it's meant to be this symbol of, this is a foretaste, this is a little sip of what we're heading for. It's like you're on your way to the party and you're getting in and you're kind of taking your coat off and your boots, and someone comes in like, here, just try a little appetizer. There's a lot more inside. That's kind of one image of communion. And so when we come up to the table to receive communion, we can be looking back, thank you for the work that you've done on my behalf. And we can look forward to, I'm so excited about the fullness when everything is put right and we can celebrate and really feast together. And there's something to enjoy now. Like, we're not there yet, but we are getting to enjoy some of the appetizer of that party right now, because we have God's presence with us even as we're going. And finally, this is all tied to baptism. Every communion gathering is a reaffirmation of our baptism. It's a remembering of, this is where my allegiance lies. And I get to enjoy and receive all the benefits of God's presence and his kingdom. I just wanted to tie in everything we've been talking about the last couple weeks around family and the new family, around the stories we're trying to tell when we gather here together, on specifically on the Big Table Sundays for communion, and even the other times that we're gathering on Sundays, we're trying to retell some aspect of that story. Does that make sense? That's all I wanted to say before our next exercise. Is there any questions about anything I just said, or thoughts, or aha moments, or yes, but what about that? In that case, at your tables, oh no, Vanessa's going to pass out some cards. We're going to play kind of a game. It's more an exercise. So it doesn't sound as fun, does it? It's a game. Let's call it a game. It's going to be a game. So in the New Testament, this idea of the new family is so central, it's so huge, it's so key, that after you have, after the Gospels, you get in Acts, you get into the letters, and you get a lot of letters from Paul and other early church leaders, and they're saturated with all these statements called one another statements. And ironically, in the Greek, it's pronounced all alone, but it's really pointing to community, right? So that's kind of funny, right? All alone means one another. Eric thinks it's not that funny. Okay, anyway, it's not that important. It's just kind of silly. So in Greek, all alone means one another. And in the New Testament, there's over 70 one another statements. There's such a concern for, this is what life in this new ordered family is meant to look like. Do this to one another. Do this for one another. This is what being with one another can be like and looks like, and it just stretches your imagination. So what we've done is we've put on these cards. We've got about 20 different cards with just a sampling of these 70 statements. If you want the full 70 deck game, you have to pay $9.99, and we have a whole package and everything. I'm just kidding, but that's a good idea, Jacob. I'm sure, write that down. But the table logo look like Trivial Pursuit and everything. We've got about 20 of these statements, and what I'd like you to do is, sorry, I lost my place. Spend a good chunk of time looking at some of these statements and have a discussion around them with one another. So, two questions, yeah, kind of three questions. Discuss, the idea is not to get through all 20 cards. We just have them there so that you can kind of sift through them, play around with them, and then kind of pass them around, and when you find one you're like, ooh, let's talk about this one, just pull it out and do it. But discuss what the statement would look like in your everyday life. And if you're part of the table, what would it look like in our table community? Be concrete. If you're part of another church, then you can talk about it in context of that community. If you're not a churchgoer, then use your family or your friends, your kind of friendship community, that whatever community you have. Like, what would this look like in your community? Secondly, which statement at your table did you feel was the most needed in any of those communities that I just mentioned? And one practical way to start the seeds of this practice or quality. Pick one you like, okay? So it's ongoing. You're not answering all three questions for each card, but you're kind of having these kinds of discussions, okay? Does that make sense? Is there any question about that exercise? Sorry, that game. Yeah, Almeida. They're right up there. They're right up there. Okay? Good? Go. Did any tables decide on which statement people felt like was most needed in your particular community? It's okay if you didn't get there. There's lots of discussion going on. Yeah.
One that we just have.
Oh.
But the one from James. It says, therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another.
Okay. That is intense.
I am. That's why. There's not therefore pray for one another. Go to other. It's scary because who wants to confess? Who is small? The other people. It was a very vulnerable thing.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I feel it in myself, and I'm sure I don't feel it. But if you can feel it, grow, it must be necessary.
It's a good one. Okay. But anyone else? Did one of the cards stand out at your table? It's like, oh, if our community could do that, that would be pretty awesome. Yeah, Kai. Sounds nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tina. Yeah. Be no stopping us. Like in a good way. Yeah. That's good. Did anyone put any thought, or maybe we could just do it right now? What would one practical way to start the seeds of some of these practices in your community? Yes, Kent. Oh, good. By all means, go for it. Let us in. I didn't want to put you on the spot if you didn't have one.
One of the things, like, never be wise in your life, you know, that helps humility. And I think, like, you also have to address this with humility. I guess, like, it makes me just kind of, you know, bring to you, yeah,
Tina. Vulnerability and these A lot of these, or maybe all of them, imply a vulnerability and a thoughtfulness. Yeah. And those things are sometimes hard. Often hard. Yeah, often hard. Kai? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Being intentional about some of those things and maybe a bit initiating. That's good. These are hard because of that vulnerability piece. We're kind of opening ourselves up to some risk if we're going to do some of these things. But it's important for us to remember the only reason that the New Testament writers are telling us 70 plus times about what to do with one another in being vulnerable and taking that step and being caring and thoughtful is it's based on the gospel. That we have, going back to our first triad of the gospel, of having a confidence, being secure, rehearsing the gospel, to remind ourselves of, oh yeah, the gospel. Oh yeah, I belong, I am secure in my identity and my belonging. That actually frees me up to not have to be so worried about what Tina's going to think of me if I kind of pursue a little bit and ask how her day is and how I can pray for her or how I can care for her or whatever the situation is, right? But if we're not rehearsing that story and remembering our security and our identity, then it's easier to kind of get caught up in a, no, I shouldn't ask, and I don't know what I'm doing, and no one's going to trust me with those questions, or whatever the stories is that we tell ourselves, right? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Do my work. And I find when I do that, it actually changes my day, changes my heart. And sometimes I get so busy and self-consumed and I don't do that. And when I actually reflect what my day was like with my patience with things at work, it's a radical difference.
Yeah.
But I think for me, something very basic, having, in my house, I have a few things that I arrange to myself. Mm-hmm. And I just find reading those over and having them in my head really helps.
Yeah. 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 Right. It's helpful. Yeah. That's good. It's helpful to remember, to remind ourselves, what story am I in? Oh, yeah. What's my character? What's my role? Because we talked a little bit at our table, just having this in front of us, same thing, where it's like, oh, yeah. Do this. Care for one another. Look out for these things. It kind of gets you ready for, expect this to be a challenge. This isn't something that often comes natural to us because we get caught up in ourselves and we're self-protecting and that sort of thing. So if I have these before me, it reminds me, okay, be ready today. It's not going to be easy, but if I'm ready and I'm thoughtful and I remember the gospel, or if I remember that big story, then it makes it a little bit more easy to do. I just want to finish up. It's 9 o'clock now, so I'm just going to talk about the three things that we do at the table. So if you're part of the table, these are obvious to you, although the reason we do them might not be obvious. We do three things. I can point to three things in our structure of the table that point to us wanting to try to take this new gospel-formed family seriously, and one of them is our house churches. So every other Sunday, if you go to the table, you know that we don't meet as a big table. We meet in homes across the city. We have six of them right now. And there's smaller groups. If you, let's see, where's the handout? Yeah. House churches, yeah. So I put down three words for our house churches: little, different, awkward. If you grew up in the 80s, like me, there is these advertisements for this medicine, this Nuprin, and everything was in black and white, and someone would have a headache or whatever Nuprin's for, and they'd put it out under their hands, and the only thing in color is these little yellow Nuprin, and they said, little, yellow, different. And I think our house churches are little, different, awkward. On purpose, because it's an alternative story. It's hard to show up at someone's house and be vulnerable in front of 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 other people. You can't hide as easily. It's more difficult. You can't be anonymous. And you're kind of forced to at least try to do some of these things on these cards, right? To care about others, to be a bit more vulnerable. And so we try to structure ourselves where we push our community a bit in the direction, in this particular direction. And so I encourage you, if you are a member of the table, go to these neighborhood tables, we call them, and embrace the awkwardness. This was our early catchphrase at the table. And just embrace it and say, God is going to trust you with the gospel, and we're going to figure this out. The other big thing we do at the table structure-wise is meals. We eat at everything. This came up in our liturgy audit at our table over here, is that meals seem to be a big deal for trying to understand family, the meaning of family in our lives and the rhythms, and that's where we connect. And we do that at the table. It's terribly inconvenient sometimes. It's a lot of logistics at times. You got to bring stuff, but we find no greater accelerant to community, to family life, than sharing a meal together and conversing. It worked for Jesus. He's doing meals all the time with everybody. And it's a way to connect. It points us to God's family table in the communion. It roots us in the goodness of creation and affirms it. And it presents opportunities for us to serve one another and to know and be known. It's like practicing for the big banquet party at the end of all time, right? We get to do that in these little communions. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about is DNA groups. DNA groups at the table are something that we just started last year. We're still trying to figure it out. And DNA stands for discipleship, nurture, and accountability. And we design them ideally as triads. So three people meet together a couple times a month. And it's our soul training. It's our practice. If we want some of these statements that we're reading tonight to become second nature, we have to learn how to practice them in community. If we can get together with two other people that we can kind of grow to trust over time, to learn to speak into one another's lives, that's what DNA groups are about. And so that's what we're working on right now. So we require all our leaders to be in a DNA group, but we make DNA groups available. We want to make DNA groups available basically to anyone in the community. And we want to talk a little bit more about this. But if you're interested at all at being in a DNA group at the table, what we're working on right now is we like to do like a probation season. So we put three people together, and it doesn't always work, right? For various reasons, logistics, other things. And so if you're interested in trying out a DNA group, we'll put you in one. We probably won't get to it till January, right? Vanessa's in charge of the DNA group, so she's putting those together. But if you are interested in one, we have some DNA cards that people can sign up for. No pressure. We're not expecting you to do it, but this is one way to try to practice. Yes, I want to be a gospel-formed, part of a gospel-formed family, and one way to do it is at a very small group level where you get to know and be known on a closer level with other people. So if you're interested at all, even if you just want to know more about it, you're not committing to it, sign up on a DNA card tonight and just leave it at your tables, and we'll collect them, and we'll get in touch with you, okay? We don't have time for this, but you can take this home. It's the personal discipleship plan, personal development plan, and it's broken down into three. And this can be your homework if you want to do it. But it's kind of like goal setting for soul training for the spiritual disciplines. And the way we've done it is looking at it through three different lenses. One is the inside. What habits do I want to form in my inner life? Habits that will promote the values I hold dear. So for if you're identifying as Christian, these will be habits that cultivate an awareness of Christ in my midst on a regular basis with a focus on rehearsing this gospel story in my life. So this is that first one from our first triad is the gospel story is so important, but we forget it so quickly because it's not in front of us, right? So this the inner one is really working on I need to get the gospel, I need to soak in it, I need to get it into my bones so I remember my identity and my security and who Jesus is. So that's what that inner focus is on. The alongside has to do with your engagement with the community. So that's the family focus. So we're a gospel-formed family. So what habits do I want to form in my primary community life? Habits that will promote the values of community life that I hold dear. For the Christian, my primary community is the family of God's people centered on Christ. So if you're part of the table, that's this group. If you're part of another community, then it would be that group. So that would be identifying how do I want to engage. So an example might be, I want to get to know people in my community better, so I'm going to try to invite someone or a family over once a week or once a month or whatever it is. That could be just one random example of a way to grow together in your communities. And finally, outside is the last one. What habits do I want to form towards those outside of my primary community, towards the stranger, towards people that I don't know very well? Habits that will reflect my values for the wider society. For the Christian, this will involve hospitality and sharing the wealth and the blessing that we have found in Christ. Part of the mission, as we'll learn in the next triad, is sharing the wealth that God has given us with the rest of the world. And that's really fun and exciting. So that's personal development plans. So a lot sometimes with our DNA groups, our little triads that we form, we have them kind of work out those personal development plans and kind of help encourage one another and come alongside each other and help form those. That's it. It's 9:08. Thank you for staying late. I apologize for going so long. And you're welcome to kind of hang out a bit and chat at your tables. I think there's more decaf coffee. Sensitive subjects. Drink it up, says Eric. And thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week for our last, the beginning of our last triad. It's the beginning of the end.